Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, August, April 3rd, 2008. I don't know where I got August from. But anyway, many topics to cover tonight. The main science topic, I will talk about an very interesting, it's a mathematical concept. It's a kind of a thought concept, what they used to call in German the Gedanken experiments, and something that I worked with in the original Cornell days when I was working on my theoretical work for this origin of the solar system by capture, how objects come in and become captured. And you can also do computer studies on this. The Russians back at that time were doing statistical studies, so there's some very interesting mathematical results. So this is a problem that can be looked at from many points of view, and that topic is the statistics of solar system formation. And statistics is a course that I taught at the university level. Basically, statistics means has to do with what happens in a many-bodied system. When many things could possibly happen, what would the end result be? And so there's many ways to look at this, as I said, with computer analysis, with mathematical statistics, by individual simulations on a computer and individual simulations visually understanding how celestial mechanics works. And that's a very interesting topic in itself, how physical bodies like planets and moons and asteroids moving in the gravitational fields of other objects, how they interact and how they act. And sometimes they act in very strange ways. So that's the main science topic, and the lead-in to that deals with Saturn, some recent developments regarding the moons of Saturn. A high-temperature moon near Saturn, how does that happen? 135 degrees Fahrenheit with water oceans below the surface and organic chemical soup visible on the surface. How does a hot moon exist around the planet Saturn, where mostly everything else out there is supposed to be frozen solid in a deep freeze? Or the moon Titan, with now they believe there are water oceans on Titan along with methane. Well, where does that methane come from out there by Saturn? So many interesting questions, but the fundamental question behind all of this, what you don't see in the news media or in the science news media, is how did these moons get there? And obviously some of them got there more recently than others, which would mean they were captured. It's already well known that Saturn has dozens of captured moons, a lot of these little ones that circle in forward and backward directions, what they call retrograde, moving counter to the motion of the bigger planets, and those typically don't last long. So it's pretty much the idea has to be broken out that Saturn has captured moons. So why not some of the big ones? And if you get to that point, why not some of the planets being captured recently, such as Venus? What is so wrong with that? Well, standard celestial mechanics does not have a method for the final stage, which is after this thing becomes captured in the solar system or by a planet, how does it eventually become locked into a nice circular orbit? And of course, that's where my work also answered that question back in the late 1970s. So all of these questions, the statistics of solar system formation, how does all of that work so that these young planets and moons can work their way into the solar system? And I want to give this at a couple different levels so that the average person out there will understand how this works, because it's very important for you to understand as well as technical people who could then take this information and do their own simulations. It's something that I did back in the late 70s, early 80s. I did a lot of this work in simulation, where I'd use computers or mathematical statistics to simulate these captures, and you learn a lot. Just let me give you a quick example before I go into the other announcements here at the beginning of the show. Imagine a solar system with all the planets revolving around the sun, the central star, and then you have moons revolving around the planets out there. And all of this is going on, and all of a sudden something comes in from afar. It's coming in on a set path. It's being dominated by the star gravitational system, but every now and then it may pass one of the smaller members and have its orbit, what we call, perturbed or changed. And so how would you study such a system? You could bring one object in at a time and study it on a computer analysis or statistically, but there's another way to do that, and that is on a computer, bring in hundreds of thousands of these objects at one time and let them all run their course, and they would be non-interacting relative to each other. In other words, when you set up the computer program, you allow all of these individual objects to interact with the existing planets, the big ones, and the star, the central star, which in this case we'd call our sun, but they don't interact with each other. And so individually they will come in and go through all kinds of gyrations. Some of them it'll just pass through the solar system and swing back out and go away. But then, statistically, what you do is you take the interesting ones, the ones that are doing something interesting, like becoming captured or having their orbits diverted, and you find out where do these end up, and you compare it to our existing solar system, and you get some very interesting results. So that will be the main science topic, and as I say, I'll try and give that at a couple different levels so that the average person will understand, and also the technical people out there, people with advanced understanding, will also be able to use this information to understand and possibly do some more modeling work on how solar systems form by capture. Okay, and just another quick note on that. The standard explanation for centuries has been that the solar system formed from a swirling dust cloud. And that theory has all kinds of problems that are theoretically not resolved. For example, all the planets would spin backwards of the direction that they spin now. So all kinds of problems with that particular concept. But at any rate, on to the initial announcements here. There's a book that, now I haven't talked about Silver Biotics for a long time, and I want to read a little bit from a book. It's by Kenneth S. Friedman, Ph.D., Dr. Kenneth Friedman, who wrote a short book, and this is available on my webpage where the Silver Biotics products are sold, the 10 part per million solution of silver in water, in purified water, and also the gel, which, by the way, works great on sunburns now that we're heading into spring and people are going to the tropics and getting sunburned. That gel is amazing. It was originally developed for burns, and so it works great on sunburns, any type of skin topical problems. But I want to read from the little book that also goes along with that product line on the web page there. And it's called The New Silver Solution, an Information Guide to Silver Solutions, and by Dr. Kenneth S. Friedman. Now, I'll go off. Here's one quote, and they're talking about viruses. There is evidence to indicate that drugs provide a genetic pressure that increases both the resistance of viruses to the drugs and also increases their virulence. Ciclovir was used with initial success, which is a antibiotic, which was used with initial success in the treatment of some of the viruses known today. But within a few years, there were far more serious cases of encephalitis relapses in patients after they stopped using the drug. Resistant strains and other viruses have appeared. These phenomena have not gone unnoticed. Now, that may sound like a little bit of complicated English, but basically here's what it means. When pharmaceutical companies develop the drugs that they want to use to treat everything from staph to encephalitis to a whole range of other common infections that attack the human body, the bacteria and the in many cases the virus are intelligent enough to develop a resistance to that drug. So now you have what you call a drug resistant or a pharmaceutical resistant virus or bacteria. Then the pharmaceutical company goes out and develops the next generation of antiviral, antibacterial drugs. Well, it doesn't take long for the viruses, etc., to learn how to mutate to become resistant. That's their job, to exist. Their development, going to change and mutate. Now that can be transmitted to someone else, and you'll find that in hospitals, these viruses, etc., have raged through the entire hospital, where the people who work in the hospital and also the other patients will get the viruses or bacteria from patients who are in the hospital. So you actually become sick with something else. You went in for a broken leg, and all of a sudden you have a staph infection that is drug resistant. And this type of thing happens. It's happened in operating rooms. There are books like The Plague Makers, which talk about this type of concept. Another book called The Coming Plague, where human viruses become resistant to antibiotics. I'll read a little bit more here. Not only researchers, but even the general public have become increasingly aware of this problem. In the past few years, the national media has focused on this problem. The Los Angeles Times, October 23, 1994, in an article entitled "Arsenal of Antibiotics Failing as Resistant Bacteria Develop." It quotes, "In the last decade, a broad resistance to antibiotics has begun to emerge. And because the bacteria can transfer genes among themselves, experts only expect the resistance to grow. The potential nightmare is an Andromeda strain, a super microbe immune to all antibiotics that would wreak havoc on the general public." Now, Andromeda strain, if you're not familiar with that term, back, I think in the, was it the 70s or 80s, there was a best-selling book and a movie made called The Andromeda Strain. And it was a virus that came in from outer space and was resistant to any attempts of modern medicine to control it. And, of course, you can imagine where the movie goes from there. But this is actually true, and now we do know that viruses do come from outer space. That's not a myth. So the bottom line is, what can the public do? And the whole point of going through this discussion in this book is to show that silver and silver in solution has been a very effective countermeasure towards viruses and bacteria. And not any silver in solution, not all of them are the same. The silver biotics is not colloidal silver. A colloidal silver is an electrolysis type of process that puts basically large, in terms of atomic size, it puts large pieces of silver in solution, and that can have a certain effect, but the silver biotics product is at an atomic level, and that's what makes it so effective. It also has a way of being carried in the bloodstream so it permeates the entire body, and it's also, you could drink gallons of this, and it wouldn't hurt you. You can put it in your eye, you can put it in your ear, you can use it on children. It's very effective for topical skin, and also I take it with me whenever I travel to counter stomach, what would you call it, infection or bacteria. Like you get, for example, if you go to Latin America, a lot of people drink the water and get sick. But this will take care of that almost instantly, the silver solution. And as I said, for sunburn, the silver gel, which is a topical gel, you put it on sunburn. It's a great, really takes care of sunburn. So at any rate, I wanted to read that, and then I'm going to quick go to another one where they talk about the treatment of water. And I just want to talk about the following issue. Between, this is, I'm reading from the book, the Dr. Kaufman book again. Between 1991 and 1902, there were 34 outbreaks of disease involving Giardia, Cryptosporidium, I don't know how to say this next one, Shigella, and hepatitis A that could be traced to drinking water. Several of these occurred in communities with high-quality water treatment facilities. The Milwaukee strain of Cryptosporidium can actually live in Clorox. So in a review of U.S. water systems, the Natural Resource Defense Council claimed that nearly 1 million Americans were getting sick each year due to water contamination. So at any rate, result here is that the new silver solution, which is what they're talking about here, the silver biotics liquid, can be used to treat water and combat a broad spectrum of waterborne infectious diseases. And so I just wanted to go through that to give you an idea of the broad range of uses for silver biotics. That's available on my webpage. Why am I talking about that? Because we're living in a time when drugs and pharmaceuticals are not the solution. Everybody knows it, but doctors continue to prescribe it. And unfortunately, what they're giving people today have very severe side effects. I know some of them can affect your liver and kidneys, and they will only allow you to take it for a certain amount of time, because the drug itself could start to damage your kidneys and liver to the point where that would kill you. So what's worse, the drug or the bacteria or virus that you have? But the silver is different. It eliminates, in most cases, 100% of the bacteria and the virus. And these are very interesting times we're living in. So that is something I always have on hand. I also, of course, sell the water filters. And if you are not your own source of fresh water, I don't even have to say anymore hardly on this show about that, because many people are waking up to that fact and ordering the water filter. It's either by mail order. I'll give that address out later. On to new topics. But I wanted to spend some time on that to let people know that there are all kinds of pathogens out there, some of them man-made, some of them natural. And, of course, this last fall we had a tremendous surge of illnesses passing around this country and the world, that crazy virus that was going around that nobody seemed to be able to identify. I talked about it on this show. Did it come from that inferior conjunction of Venus? Or was it man-made? And I don't know any laboratories, the World Health Organization, the CDC in the United States, none of these organizations made a statement of what that was that everybody was getting. So at any rate, you are your own first line of defense, and very doubtful if going to the doctor is going to help you. In fact, I know specifically that in those cases, if you went to the doctor would simply say, you're on your own. There's nothing we can do for you. So at any rate, just a quick announcement on new releases coming up. I'm sorry I don't have a confirmation announcement this week. I thought I would have everything ready to announce this week, but there are actually four releases kind of stacked up here waiting to go out. And as I said before, it's kind of like having a baby or something. It just doesn't happen until all the pieces are in place. But just be patient, and I know you're going to really like what's coming out of the release shoot here very shortly. I would say probably by next week I'll be making announcements on that. Spring weather. Yuck. Well, of course, Minnesota, last 2 days has been snowing. And schools have been closed. This is April 1st and 2nd. March 31st and April 1st, I should say. School closings were rampant. It was not a real deep snow, but it was wet. And right at that 32-degree place where things freeze, first it kind of rains and drizzles and freezes, then it snows. Makes for tremendously bad driving conditions. Now throughout the southwest, southeastern, southern United States, tremendous rains again. Another storm system moving through just this past couple of days, moving eastwards through the entire central to southern United States. Some severe storms moving around the world at very low latitudes. They're in the southern hemisphere basically, moving off of that nub off of Western Africa, but in general, not really that far out of the statistical patterns for this time of year. So I would say that the weather is within normal bounds for what we're seeing here. A lot of times the northern states can get continued rain and snow, sometimes even into May. So hopefully that won't happen, but as I said, nothing out of the ordinary. And as I said earlier, I made my 2008 weather predictions. 2008 should be a relatively bland year, unless, of course, we have manipulated weather, which we haven't seen in some time. A review of Comet Holmes. And, of course, this past week, a bunch of disinformation being floated out on the internet. Of course, I did a whole series of radio shows, specials on Comet Holmes when it first came out, and identified the activity of Comet Holmes as being due to an electrical alignment of Venus and Mars and Mercury, the planet Mercury. Those lined up on that date, October 23rd, and guess where little Comet Holmes was? Right in line also. So at any rate, very clear that Comet Holmes was the victim of a solar system electrical alignment of planets. And then it continued to move and then had another conjunction with Earth. And at that time, we had the Christmas severe weather. Remember all of that? And also, at about that time, we had a conjunction with Venus in early November, I believe it was. That was when Venus swung around between us and the sun, and that's when all that illness began. That's what leads me to think that it could have easily been one of the Venus viruses, which were known about back as far as 1200 AD by the Chinese and well documented in the medical journals. The fact that every time Venus comes around between us and the sun, there is an increase in the sunspots and an increase in viruses, human pathological viruses that affect humans on Earth. So at any rate, what's Comet Holmes doing now? It's moving off. It has not been visible to amateur astronomy equipment here for some time. But remember that I made the announcement that in 2050, there's a good chance that Comet Holmes will be captured and adopted by Jupiter. So it's definitely going to have a perturbing effect on the orbit of Comet Holmes. Whether it becomes captured or not, we will have to see. It depends on the next, 40-some years of tail drag and orbital change that Comet Holmes will go through to see where it's going to be exactly as it comes in and nears Jupiter in the year 2050. So hopefully we'll all be around at that time to view that. But I just wanted to give a Comet Holmes review, and of course I have the Comet Holmes subpage on my homepage. Go check that out, and it's full of information and details regarding the issues regarding Comet Holmes. And clearly there are some imposters and wannabes on the internet trying to run around and do copycat work and pretend like they're putting out information, but in general it's very poorly conceived information by people who are not scientists trying to pretend like they're scientists, that type of thing. So it's important to keep up on these things, keep the public directed towards real science and real understanding of these events. And Comet Holmes, of course, I did many shows on that, both as a guest and my own shows, tracking that every week so that you had sound information on that. So if you want, go back to the late October, early November time frame, leading all the way into Christmas time, the end of the new year, and into the early 2008 time frame. All of my shows contained information on Comet Holmes. Interesting flux, flurry, what would you call it? A blizzard of information regarding Planet X and disinformation coming out over the past week. And some are almost comical, some are ridiculous, some may be disinformation, and then there's some stories that probably should never have made the news at all, but are being blasted all over the front pages. So all of a sudden, there's many Planet X experts out there who've come out of the old woodwork, never heard of them before, have no credentials, and all of a sudden, they're a Planet X expert, and they're being posted as such. And you find out, well, where did they get their degree? They don't have any, or they have some kind of a degree that came out of Cracker Jack box someplace. You know, this is the kind of thing that's being posted, and these people, all, if you look at the type of thing they're saying, they're trying to mix up all of the good information that I put out in the past. So disinformation about Planet X, be ready to see barrages of this, and one wonders why this always happens around this time of year. But one of the stories I'll talk specifically about, in Russia, they're being billed as a crazy cult. They're in a cave, and they're claiming they're going to stay there, claiming that the world is going to end in May of 2008, and they're trying to coax these people out of a cave. Well, you know, if somebody wants to go in a cave and sit there, big deal. Why would you put that on the front page of every newspaper in the world? Well, you would only do that if you wanted to make this topic just crazy as can be. And that's what happened before. The disinformation ploys are to make Planet X a crazy topic and to make people associate Planet X with crazy people. Claiming, apparently this cult, is claiming that they're going to blow up the cave and lock themselves inside if they're forced to leave. And they have negotiators over there and everything. And I thought, you know, if some guy wants to go and sit in the cave and take his friends and they think the world is going to end, well, let them sit there. Why would I care? Why would I send a negotiator there? And what's the big deal? A bunch of guys sitting in a cave. Let them sit there. If they want to go sit and dig a hole in the ground and sit there, it doesn't affect me. And why would anybody blast this all over the front page of the newspaper? And unless, as I say, you wanted to make Planet X into a cult crazy topic. And that's what they've always done in the past. And by the way, just as a little point of review, back in the 2003, the May 15th, 2003 crazy thing, there was a planned suicide with so-called cult members in Japan and all of that, and I was instrumental in stopping that because NASA dribbled the information out actually about 3 days before the May 15th date that there were all of these suicides about to occur, one in Florida, one in Japan, and one in Wisconsin, where there was going to be a big, some kind of a Kool-Aid party there, or James Jones type party, and then one in Europe, and they were going to have these mass suicide things around the world and blast it all over the news and airwaves. And so I got a hold of NASA and I said, you have 3 days to stop this. If you don't use your power of the press to announce that what people are really going to be seeing is a big orange full moon and not Planet X, then the guilt of all of this will rest on your shoulders. And I made it very public. And so NASA, guess what? All of it got called off. There were no mass suicides. You never heard about it again. And 10 years of disinformation ploy went down the drain overnight because a couple stupid people in their chain, some of the white hat professional astronomers, spilled the beans 3 days early about the suicides. And so I put it on NASA's shoulders, and I said, you're going to be responsible if these people commit suicide because you could have put it in the press that this is going to be a big orange full moon and not Planet X coming up over the horizon. So anyway, we're starting to see that kind of crazy stuff again here. And in my way of viewing it, it's probably all constructed BS from the disinformation crews whose job it is to make Planet X a crazy topic amongst you, the public. But one thing you'll notice is that the true story of Planet X, or what I call the many Planet X's, the real story is never mentioned in these news articles. So it's very clear the intent is to make Planet X a crazy topic. Just a quick note here. When manufacturing goes abroad, when manufacturing tries to cut corners, as is being done today, then the chain, let's take a car where parts are being manufactured someplace. The end result is a car that has parts that have never been put under quality control. About 10 years ago, the United States and the world went through a huge, huge undertaking to create something called ISO standards. And these were, I believe, like 9000, 9001, 9002. And the British had their own set of standards for various manufacturing processes. And there was a very strict set of requirements that you had to pass to have your manufactured item marked as ISO compatible, in other words, international standard for manufacturing. And that went by the wayside when everybody started shipping their manufacturing off to China and other foreign countries because there were no standards. Then they bring those parts in, put it into an automobile or some other manufactured end product, and what do you have? You have a manufacturing nightmare. You have, and the public is the one that's paying for this. As I said before, light switches, light fixtures, anything mechanical, automobiles. A lot of times you pick these things up and they fail the first time. Bolts, screws that have to be set to a certain standard. The part where you put the bit in to put a screw into the wall or to put a wrench or a socket on to turn the bolt, are not, the head of the bolt or screw, what I'm saying, is off size and varies so much that a lot of times you cannot get a socket on them. And this is the kind of junk you get. You get screws that will break apart as you're trying to put it into a piece of wood. You get heads that break off of bolts when you're trying to put it together on a car or other type of manufactured product. You get drills that don't work. The chucks don't hold the drill bits. The drill bits themselves break and have flaws in them. The that cannot keep a sharp edge. This is the kind of junk that we're getting in the United States. So not only is the United States failing economically, not only is it failing in the way of housing and mortgage crisis, it is failing in the manufacturing and assembly of products that go out to the general public. In fact, I would be very leery of buying any new products on the market at all, because unless they're specific, there's a few things that are still made in the United States under strict standards, but I find that shoes break apart. The seams around the bottom of tennis shoes come apart very quickly. All kinds of issues that are cropping up. Shoes that don't have support in them, or the support breaks down very quickly, that the base of the shoe is actually hollow. So you look at the shoe and it looks like this nice shoe, but in the middle of the sole of the shoe, it's actually hollow and it's going to break down very rapidly. So what you're finding is manufacturing, using foreign manufacturing and manufacturing without standards, is rampant today. And something that I do keep an eye on a very regular basis, but I feel sorry for anybody trying to build a house today, because all of the working components, all of that made in China, and it's in a lot of cases the light switches break the second time you use them, the breakers, the motors in the fans, the light bulbs burn out the second time you turn on the light switch, just on and on. So why am I talking about that? Because it's part of the failure of the United States, where your greedy businessmen try and make a quick buck, and the end result is that our country, I just talked to somebody who grew up in Detroit, and he told me that he went back up to his hometown, and he went down, I think it was called Plymouth Street or Avenue something, and he said that used to be lined with factories that made everything in the world. Every type of product, he said, they're all boarded up and gone. And he said, you wouldn't believe it, it looks like death row up there. But that's what's happened to this country. It's been gutted. And that manufacturing will never come back. It's like our space program. At one time, we had engineers who could build rockets and rocket engines. That's all gone. The knowledge and that. Here's something that once you break the cycle of one generation coming up and learning the business and improving on it, once you break that cycle, you're not going to get it back, at least for a very, very, very long time, if at all. Plus all the organization of this company shipping to that one and this company depending on the quality of that company over there, because they make good bolts and this company makes good other parts, and you put them together and you have a good product and that isn't happening anymore. What we've got is chaos and junk. And that's what happens when you get a bunch of greedy businessmen in power who don't understand the environment of engineering and manufacturing, that only want a quick profit. On to the main science topic. I'm going to start talking about Saturn, the organic soup that has been found on the moon of Saturn, and the moon Enceladus. Sounds like a salad in Spanish. But Enceladus is the small moon of Saturn that they now show is 135 degrees Fahrenheit, 63 degrees hotter than they had previously believed. Now, they have geyser plumes coming up to an altitude of 120 miles off the surface of this. Remember, Earth's own atmosphere is only about 60 miles high, about 100 kilometers. That's considered the edge of outer space. These plumes, these water geyser plumes coming out of the surface of this small moon are going up 120 miles. That would be far into outer space if it were on Earth. And I love the NASA comment that these are icy plumes. Now, wait a minute. somewhere down there you need some energy, folks. So it might be icy water, but there's some serious energy going on down there that can pump water 120 miles vertical straight up in a geyser. And now they're saying the temperature is 135 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm suspecting that down beneath there, the inner core temperature of Enceladus is far, far higher. They're also discovering organic molecules, complex organic molecules, they're claiming, as they view this small moon. Titan, the large moon of Saturn, now is believed to have water oceans on it, or large lakes at least. And, of course, it's known to have methane. Now, methane on Earth, someone would claim that these are due to fern forests and biological life on Earth. Well, how many of you out there are going to believe that the moon Titan of Saturn has had large fern forests? I'm not seeing many hands go up on that. So what exactly is going on? And then that brings back the question back to Earth. How did our methane form on this planet? And I've said this all along, that Earth's oil and methane and those type of organic chemicals, the hydrocarbons, etc., had to come from outer space. And that is exactly what happened. But now that they're on these planets and moons far out in the solar system, you have to understand that when you look back at the sun from Saturn, if you were out at Saturn looking back at the sun would look about like an average bright flashlight. That's about what the sun would look like. It would look like kind of a distant big star, bigger than average star. That's what it would look like if you were at Saturn. So you can't convince anybody that that is the source of heat out at Saturn. Now, years ago, when they first started sending space probes and the Cassini mission out to Saturn, I said they will find a couple things. They're going to find Titan to be much warmer than believed. They're going to find hydrocarbons in its atmosphere, and it's not. They cannot use the greenhouse effect as they did on Venus. They're not going to be able to use the greenhouse effect to claim it as the high temperature of these moons out there. And lo and behold, here we have Enceladus, far hotter on the surface, 135 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of Enceladus, with geysers, water geysers, shooting 120 miles up into the air off the surface. Gee, I wonder what could be going on out there. So this tells you one thing. These objects, Enceladus, Titan, and dozens of other moons around Saturn, which I talked about at the beginning of the show, are recent acquisitions. How much more clearly can I say that? How much more clearly can, you know, a scientist look at this? And how can they not understand that this idea that the solar system formed all at one time simply, absolutely cannot be true? Yet, all of the college textbooks, all of the graduate course study in astronomy still paints this ridiculous picture of the solar system forming all at one time from a dust cloud billions of years ago. I went through a whole litany of items last week relative to the same concept, that, you know, this idea that the solar system forming at one time simply cannot be true. That you look around at the moons of Jupiter, they're all very different. Very, very, very different. So wouldn't you expect them to be pretty much the same if they formed all at the same time billions of years ago and nothing has happened since? That's what I would expect. But they're all different. They show one is extremely hot, the most volcanic object in the solar system, to the point where it's molten and has volcanic activity all over the surface. And you have a moon right next to it that's frozen solid. What's wrong with this picture? You know, so anyway, the point of bringing up these topics is that this leads in nicely to the idea of, well, how did the solar system form? And that topic I solved back in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was published in my book. There's a chapter in, you'll find this at the end of my Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes books. I have reprinted the late 1979 work. It's called Statistics of Solar System Formation, and it talks about capture. Now, the entire idea of capture, of course, is well known in statistics and celestial mechanics, and this is how it works. An object comes in a two-body system, like, say, the Sun and Jupiter, or the Sun and Saturn. An object comes in, and there's a gravitational interaction between the two objects and the third object coming in. So Jupiter and Saturn can capture a third object coming in. Let's simplify this and go down to one object. Let's say that the Sun were there all by itself. There were no planets. There were no moons out there. It was just the Sun sitting there all by itself. And an object comes in from the far remote edge of the outer space, way beyond what we now call the solar system. And this object comes in. It loops around the Sun, and it would go back out to as far out as it came from. And it would continue to do that forever. It would never become captured around the Sun. So how exactly does the Sun then capture objects into its realm? Well, it needs a second object, and this is well known from celestial mechanics. You need the second object for the capture process to work, and it's somewhat complicated. The NASA and the engineers, that the great unsung heroes of NASA, the engineers who make those marvelous spacecraft that go out into outer space, those engineers understand this, and they use it in reverse many times to use gravitational interactions to fling an object out and make it go faster. So they use that same principle in reverse. So the capture, instead of capturing an object, they will use the gravitational assist, it's called, to throw a spacecraft out farther in the solar system and make it get to its end destination faster than you could do it if you just use chemical propulsion. So at any rate, and that actually comes into play because you could have objects in the solar system that have been captured that unwittingly become close to one of the planets and gets tossed out of the solar system. You could have this just as easily as you could have capture. But it's actually somewhat of a rare event. You'll also find that capture is favored for objects moving in the prograde direction. In other words, Jupiter moves in a certain direction and establishes the movement pattern of the solar system. Everything else, anything trying to move counter to that direction is going to have a tough time. It's going to start to have its orbit perturbed, and it'll either end up colliding with something or being thrown out of the solar system. And this is based on results that the Russian mathematicians were working on back in the 70s. And so I was able to pick up on that work and get some end results also. And the way they were working with this, they were also dealing with multiple objects moving in a solar system and trying to figure out what would happen. And there was a very interesting result. Here's what they were specifically working on. They were working on star systems. They were trying to understand why we have a majority of double star systems in the universe. There are some three star systems or triple star systems, but very, very rarely do you find four stars in a system orbiting each other, and almost never do you find five or more. So the primary grouping of stars in the universe, about 75% of them are in double systems. And about, I think it was about 22% of them were in triple systems, and the rest of the stars seem to be single stars, just a star by itself. And so when they looked at the triple stars, they realized something very interesting. that the secondary two stars were actually orbiting each other in a pair quite distant from the primary star. So they actually acted like two double star systems. The one little pair was orbiting it off in a distance, and so the big main star saw them as one. Kind of like Earth-Moon system is viewed from our sun's perspective as one object, because we're so close relative to the sun. So the triple star systems are stable because the secondary and tertiary, the third object, are close together, far from the main big star. And that's why triple star systems exist. But above that, you don't find a fourth star in general. And that's because once you throw in a fourth object, it's going to wander around until it gets thrown out of the system. And that was one of the great statistical results that came from the Russian work. And that, again, is referenced in my papers back in the appendix of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. The appendix has some of my original published papers from back in that time frame. And it's in a chapter, as I said, called Statistics of Solar System Formation. So how does one study this? Well, there's a couple different ways. You could get on a computer and take one object from the far distant outer regions of the solar system. You could computer simulate the solar system with Jupiter and Saturn and Earth and all the other planets and moons and allow this object to come in and trace it and see where it went. And that's a very slow process. It's not very productive. So what you do is you take about 1,000 objects and you put them in a grid work coming all into the solar system at one time. And as I said earlier, these are non-interacting. In other words, they don't interact with each other in the computer simulation. They only interact with the nine planets or whatever, moons of the solar system and the sun. And so now all of a sudden you have 1,000 objects coming in evenly spaced apart, and pretty soon you're going to find out which ones are going to have some interesting results. Most of them are going to come into the solar system, flip around the sun, and go back out and not come back. But some of them, statistically, are going to start to become captured. And so you start setting up the solar system in different arrangements, and you let this array of objects, you call them test points, come into the solar system and interact with the solar system. And then you pick out the ones that are interesting, the ones that are becoming captured. What's going to happen to them? Are they going to become planets? Are they going to move into the asteroid belt where there's a lot of room for them to move? Are they going to become a comet family member of Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus or Neptune, the big planets that all have comet families associated with them, all of which are captured? Or will they eventually become a moon, or will they eventually become a planet? And in addition to this modeling, computer modeling, you add in another factor, which is part of my comet theoretical work. That is, as these objects move into the solar system, they become a comet. They discharge the solar capacitor, and they have what is known as tail drag. In other words, as they move through the solar system, they are collecting material by attracting it into the nucleus. All of this material being drawn into this object, and it puts a drag on the object. It drags it back, so to speak, and changes its orbit. And that's the essential part that's needed. Once these objects start to become planets, once they start to become asteroids, once they start to move around a planet and become captured as a moon, this tail drag then accentuates and it reduces the orbit to a circular orbit. And that's why you have all of these objects out here in stable circular orbits. That is one of the extremely essential components of capture and the statistics of capture and the formation of solar systems by capture. What does this mean to you, the average guy on the street? Well, when we see comets coming into the solar system, they are following a pattern. They're just one object. But if you look over, say, a 100,000-year period, what if you could statistically put on a computer screen all the comets and all of the little objects and all the bigger objects that have come through our solar system in the past 100,000 years or the past million years or the past billion years. You would be doing something similar to this computer simulation that I just talked about. And you would see some of them becoming captured. You would see some of them become captured and then thrown out of the solar system again. And statistically, from this computer analysis, you would start to get an idea of how rare it is for an object to become captured and then become a member of the solar system. You would also learn that objects that try and go against the grain, they try and move in the wrong direction, they don't last long. They're going to become perturbed. They're going to crash into another planet. They're going to be thrown out of the solar system. They're not going to be very abundant. The only place you're going to find these are in that, you're going to find these in the region between, say, Mars and Jupiter, where there's a big, vast region where there's no planet to affect them. So you'll see a lot of these moving in all directions out there. And there's a real misnomer about the asteroid belt. Some people think of the asteroid belt as something like the rings of Saturn, this nice flat ring, and everything's moving around in nice orbits. Well, that's really not the case. It's like a giant, very fat donut. And the objects in that region are moving in all directions, in all kinds of orbits, and not in some kind of nice plane, as with Saturn's rings. So I just want to dispel that myth. And those objects typically can be associated with captured objects. They're objects that have finally worked their way into a region. And in my paper, I also use this example. I think it's in the Saturn paper that's also in the appendix of that book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. It's kind of like a truck driving down a gravel road. If the truck or car drives down a gravel road every day in the same spot, dust or little pebbles will bounce around, and eventually they'll bounce out of the track where the car always drives, and then they'll stay out. Once they're out of there, they're out of there, and they won't bounce back because the truck or car doesn't drive there. It only drives. So eventually what you get is a path that's kind of cleared of all the little pebbles because they eventually get bounced out of there. And so that's what happens when you have a planet. They clear out the area of the planet path, and so you get these nice, neat zones where there's not a whole lot, and that's where Earth and the other planets, Jupiter, etc., they kind of sweep out these areas, and that's where I got the name for Saturn's sweeper moons predicted because of this sweeping process. So at any rate, that gives you somewhat of an idea of how solar systems form and how they maintain themselves. Now, if all of a sudden a very large object comes in, imagine something like one of the many, many, many objects out there that might be Earth-sized or Jupiter-sized that comes in, and they have around them kind of a mini solar system, and all of a sudden this starts moving into our solar system, you could similarly computer analyze that type of an object and get an estimate of where these things might end up. So that's what I'm personally constantly looking for, are those kind of objects that might come in. And if I find out, and I don't have any information at this time that there is such an object, but if there is, I would be announcing it on my homepage and on this radio show. So that's what a lot of people keep tuned for, and plus just the general understanding of how all of these things work and what to look for. I said I'd quick give the address. It's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota, 55392. It's $339 for the Berkey water filter and another $60 for the add-on fluoride filters. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.